May it please the court.
Certainly.
This case was decided in the circuit court on the issue of whether or not the regulations in effect at the time of the driver's arrest required that the breath analyzer machine be calibrated and maintained using three different simulator solution levels as opposed to a single simulator solution
level. Is it procedural or substance? Isn't the machine working, wouldn't this machine working in a DWI case be substantive versus procedural?
No, Your Honor, the cases have all that have addressed this issue have always found, and I think uniformly, that the maintenance regulations are in fact a procedural matter. The substance is you know, the fact of whether or not someone, I think, is driving while intoxicated.
Do you agree with me it's a foundational requirement for admission into evidence?
It is a foundational requirement.
Then why does it matter whether it's procedural or substantive?
Well, the where it matters in this case is the question of retroactive versus prospective application, because substantive law is always to be applied prospectively, but procedural issues can be applied retroactively.
Well, why does that matter here when the new law says that reports done under the old law shall be judged by the old law? I'm not quoting the exact language.
It says something a little bit different than that. What it says is that a test that was valid under the regulations in effect at the time it was conducted shall remain valid under the new regulation. That is a very specific and limited exception to the retroactive application requirement.
So you're saying the state gets the benefit both ways, though, as I read your argument. You're saying if it was okay under the old law applies. If it's okay under the new law applies. Defendant, you lose either way.
That is exactly the way it's written.
And if we ever, what do you cite that's ever held that?
Well, certainly the plain language of the rule itself. I mean, you have to find a valid rule that becomes invalid because of a more stringent regulation for that subsection to apply. And the Hunt case is one, I think, the first one that addressed that, and it dealt with exactly that situation. You had a test that was valid at the time it was applied. By the time of trial, a new, more stringent regulation had come into effect that would have made that test invalid under that new, more stringent regulation, but the language, that subsection 8 language, was used to apply the standard that was in effect at the time that was done.
And I think we can all understand if an officer or officers followed the procedures that were in effect in the law at the time the test was done, that those are the ones that should guide us in as a if it's a procedural issue as to whether or not they properly followed the law. But you're saying, but if it wasn't, we can just change the regulation afterwards and make it okay. And right. I really am unclear as a matter of public policy or statutory interpretation why that is the law or should be the law.
Well, that I can only say I think that has been the general rule, is that procedural matters such as this are given retroactive application, because I think and I haven't gone back and really, since law school, perhaps gone into the philosophical underpinnings of that, but I can say that has been the standard principle that has been applied consistently in any kind of case, not just this. And because I think procedures deal with, you know, the procedures for conducting a trial, I think that's why it's considered appropriate to look at the time of trial in determining what procedures should be used, because I think it's felt that those procedures, as they've been updated, are the ones that best ensure that the trial is conducted.
And certainly for the trial itself, that would be the case. But we're talking about whether a test done previously that didn't comply with the law suddenly now is okay, not should a trial occur under procedures that were in place at the time of the event. Of course, the trial is going to be conducted according to the current rules of court, but you're validated an invalid thing. We were talking in the prior case about sandbagging, kind of waiting and seeing if, you know, you just wait and see what's being attacked and change. Not that the state has done that, I'm confident it hasn't, but it would encourage people to issue a regulation every time there's a problem and take care of that.
Well, I think Judge Fisher's question hit on why this is properly viewed as procedural and why it does go to the conduct of the trial, and that this is a foundational requirement for admitting the breath test result. And so it's an admissibility of evidence standard, just like any other evidentiary rule. Mm-hmm. And changes in evidentiary rules are applied retroactively. That's as a matter of course. This is an evidentiary rule, plain and simple. And that's why it's proper to view it as a procedural rule and to give it retroactive application in a situation such as this.
So if previously, one date, you're found not guilty or there's no probable cause, and then the state changed the law, then retroactively, then you could call procedural and say, now you are guilty?
Well,
because
again,
you changed the testing and now you are guilty when before you were found not guilty or there's no probable cause? But that's it, you can just wipe that out, the presumption before?
Well, if you're talking about probable cause, I think that probably comes closer to a substantive issue. But again, it's the manner in which the test was conducted to get the breath test reading. That's a wholly separate issue. Again, that's an evidentiary piece and a foundation for establishing the admission of the breath test result is to show that it was done in compliance with certain standards. So it's not changing the breath test result. Just changing the admissibility of it as a procedural matter, and that's why, again, if the regulations in effect at the time of trial indicate that a test conducted under those standards is reliable as evidence, that's what we're talking about here, is the evidentiary value of it, not the substances aspect of whether or not you've actually violated the law. And that is why it's proper, I think, to provide the retroactive application in a case like this.
What is your argument regarding whether it complied with either regulation?
Yeah, and I was about to turn to that. It's when we look at the rules regarding the maintenance and calibration of the breath test, we have to look at the rules as a whole and not just cherry pick certain parts of that. And when you look at the rules as a whole that were in effect at the time of this driver's arrest, they did not require that three different simulator solution levels be done to conduct the maintenance checks.
When you say that, that's kind of a gloss over. You're suggesting that this case requires applying a rule of construction. I mean, you're assuming that by reading the one that's applicable here, that you have to go past the particular standard to determine whether it is. I mean, generally, we only apply rules of interpretation, like parametry or whatever, right, if we don't understand from the plain meaning what is required.
Yeah.
This is a particular foundational requirement, a test. Why do we need to, and it doesn't seem to be confusing to me, why do we need to read everything else to determine whether or not this particular foundational requirement is met or not?
Well, my argument doesn't go so much to the plain language and the meaning of the language as it does the construction of the scope of the rule. What does the rule require be done? What does it not require be done?
In effect, you're arguing that one doesn't look at the plain meaning of a particular sentence. You look at the plain meaning of any sentence in the context of the entire rule.
Exactly, how it all fits together. I mean, we're not saying that and means something different than and, or that or means something different at or. We're just saying this particular rule that contains the word and only defines the solutions that may be used, but does not say how those solutions are to be used in conducting the test.
Then why does it say and?
Well, that's a good question, and I think the reason was is that all three of these were available to be used, and I think once, you know, obviously we saw these cases, this argument develop, we saw courts ruling in this manner, I think it became clear very quickly that the rule was being applied in a way that was never meant to be applied.
Well,
and why would we think it
was never meant to be applied when opposing counsel cited laws in a multitude of other states that clearly purposefully use and? I mean, at some point, clearly the department decided they just wanted or and changed it to or, but there's nothing in the rule itself that suggests that the department at the time they adopted that didn't mean and, just like the dozen other states that use and require multiple tests of different solutions at different levels.
Well, I think the intent goes back to the statement of purpose in the proposed rule when it was first published before it was adopted, which says this rule adds 0.08% as another concentration level available for performing accuracy checks and instrument recalibrations. Nothing in that statement of purpose indicated it was to be used in addition to anything else, but it's just to give more options to the officers that were performing these checks. And the fact is, too, is that...
And was the word and added at that time also, though?
I'm talking about the proposed rule that added the word and.
But that's my point. I mean, they didn't just add another one and say, use one of these. They said and added that in.
What's the other language that you are, besides the one you just mentioned, is there other language that indicates that it only needed to be tested with one solution?
Well, certainly, I mean, what the rule says is that the standard simulator solutions are to be used in that way. But I think what's more importantly is to look at the other rules that apply this also. Is 0.031 that sets out the fact that the it sets out the forms that are to be used in conducting the tests, and then 0.060, which I think says when using these particular forms, and I think this one was the Alco sensor, as subsection 3. When using Alco sensor 4 with printer, the procedures on the form included herein shall be performed and the form shall be completed. And the forms themselves have remained unchanged from the pre-2012 amendments all the way through. There's nothing except for adding a check mark for those that use the 08.
But you argue that because the form only allows you to make one
specifically says one report.
Right. Yes. But then your opposing counsel cites cases where each form is used each time a different level of is being applied. So why wouldn't that be reasonable that if you did do the 0.08 or the 0.10, why wouldn't you just use two different forms to report that?
Well, here's what I'd say. For years and years and years, and I don't know how many, but officers have been using one simulator solution, filling out one form. If what they're saying is true, and we now have to require three simulator solutions, and we're talking about a total of nine.
We wouldn't have to now because the regs have been changed.
Right. Well, now, but
the issue is whether or not you make them follow their own rule, really.
Right,
but what that rule says.
Is it not reasonable to think that if we're making that radical a change that we would clearly inform these officers that the way you've been doing it all these years is no longer the right way and you've got to do it?
Actually, they introduced evidence that there were a number of cases where two forms were used and two tests were done.
No, they introduced two instances of that by one officer. We don't know why he did it that way. And certainly a person can go beyond the rules if they want to and do more, but that doesn't mean the rule requires.
Was there any expert testimony in this case that the equipment is more accurate if it's tested at all three solutions?
No.
Less accurate?
There was no expert testimony in this case. And even if it's a matter of policy, there'd be any advantage to that, and I can't really speak to
it. Well, they cite the federal regulations that require it to be, before you can validate use of a machine, you have to test it at all those different levels rather than just one level. Isn't that some evidence that the feds at least think it makes it more accurate?
It's some evidence that other jurisdictions have decided to adopt that requirement, but the issue here is did Missouri adopt that requirement? And I think the whole course of the rule.
Well, I think the question was, is there any reason to think it's more valid if you test it more than one level, and that a dozen states and the federal government require that to be done in order to have the machine be valid and be able to be used, is certainly some evidence of that.
I think there's probably, my guess is there are probably disagreements on that issue. You could probably find people that would advocate both ways.
Is there anything in the record saying that?
No, there's not. And I see I've gone over my time, so thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
So first, as a matter of procedure, let me explain, and I know you granted me leave to file my brief late, but why I filed my brief late, because there's this other case out there, Riggins, from the Southern District, that's in conflict with the Eastern District. Originally, I was called and asked if I could argue this case, the last case of the last term, as opposed to the first or second case of this term, and I said yes. And the reason that didn't happen is because there's this Riggins case out here from the Southern District that still remains on your list of cases, whether or not it should be transferred. And that's because the Southern District declined transfer, knowing that the Southern District and the Eastern District on the exact same day ruled the opposite way. The Eastern District did what I think is the appropriate thing. They transferred the case here to resolve the conflict. So I assumed when I stood here that I would be representing Mr. Riggins and Ms. Steers on the argument, so I waited to file my brief for a transfer that never occurred. Upon receiving notice that the case was set, I filed this brief. I think there's lots of reasons the Riggins case is wrong, but I think there are more reasons that Judge Hoff wrote a very strong opinion in the Eastern District that answers most of the questions I heard you guys asking Mr. McPherson. But let me start off by saying, in 2012, which is the amended we're talking about, the Department of Health and Senior Services updated their regulations in a variety of ways, all of which increased the scientific reliability of breath tests. For example, those regulations required a type 2 or type 3 to do the observation period. They required simulators be verified against the National Institute of Standards and Technologies. They required maintenance checks to be done at three levels rather than one. I agree with Judge Fisher, which I almost always agree with all of you, but when
nice recovery.
When he says that it's foundational, all these foundational requirements were designed to make more tests accurate. As it relates to reading the entire statute, the Eastern District said, no, you don't have to read it. There's nothing confusing about this. And I gave you that chart. There are five cases that were in the Eastern District that were dismissed on the same day the brief in my case was filed. Okay? And he says in his brief that there are two additional cases that dispute that fact. Well, if you look at the dates of the orders, the dates of the orders in the five cases I'm talking about were before the effective date of the new statute. The dates of the two other cases, the order was signed afterwards. So when they were going through and trying to dismiss cases, it's my position that they conceded that the old regulation meant what the old regulation said, and that the only argument in this case is retroactivity. There's another reason the old regulation, the 2012 regulation, meant what it said. For the first time...
Could I ask you, because it is a question of law,
right,
what the regulation says, whether they concede anything has no impact on that. So a party can't concede a question of law. The court will determine it. So you're wanting us not to review that area, but
I have plenty of reasons that support my argument, and that's where I'm going to. I'm just saying as a practical matter, that's something that you should consider. The second reason is that for the first time, 051, which is the section that has the and in it, said the calibration and accuracy standards, verified standards, must be followed. That's not something in the Missouri Register about the purpose. That's new language. To me, it indicates that they were trying to say you need to use three standards to make the calibration and accuracy verification. 051 used to have a different title entirely. When he's talking about 031 and type Form 7s and the Riggins Court is talking about all that, none of that was ever before the trial court. In the case, in my case, okay, it was continued for the Department of Revenue to present evidence about this. They were going to call someone from the Department of Health and Senior Services to talk about what their intent was. They didn't do that. In the Eastern District, I argued that if it was the Department of Health and Senior Services' position that they weren't changing anything, then the Department of Health and Senior Services could have intervened in this case. They could have filed an amicus brief. There could be some evidence of what the people who wrote the rule meant to say other than its plain language, because that's what they're trying to get you to do.
We normally give weight to how an agency interprets their regulations. Is there evidence in this case that indicates they interpreted it to only require testing calibration with one solution?
No, the evidence is to the contrary. The evidence is they said they were going to present evidence. It's in the transcript.
That's what I understood that you're suggesting that these dismissals, you use the word concession.
Right.
But what I would understood your argument is that's some evidence that they knew that they were required.
That was their interpretation.
That was their interpretation.
But that's some evidence of how they interpreted their own rule.
Correct. Okay. And
opposing counsel says it's not unambiguous, because normally if something's unambiguous, there's nothing to construe. And he says, but you, in determining that, you also have to look at the forms, and that I'm not sure if it either creates or clarifies an ambiguity, but you can't just look at that section. You have to look at all of them. Can you address whether we need to do that? And if we do, does that change the interpretation?
No. Yes, I can address it. No, you don't need to do that.
Good answer.
Okay.
Good answer.
And the reason is that it's all within 120.31.51. That's the section we're construing. And word and means and, are means are. And they, if it's unambiguous, you don't look past the plain meanings. If you wanted to say that the type 031 talks about the type 2 permit, E, required duties. It doesn't talk about the foundational requirements for the admission of a breath test. If that were true, why did they change the rule in 2014 back to R? It was R, they changed it to AND, then they didn't like the requirement that was imposed on them, so they went back to R. That would seem to be another admission.
I think there's a question over here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Would you go ahead and address Section 8, the Savings Clause?
Yeah, I think the Hunt case, which was written with the exception of the seven people here by three of the most intelligent judges that ever served on the Eastern District, actually with the exception of three of you. It was written by Judge Simon, Judge Mooney, and Judge Crane, who are three people of different perspectives. And the language says, in interpreting this clause, it says, it was clearly and unambiguously intended to supersede the retrospective application, limiting the rule's application to its effective date and subsequent. It is valid and done with the compliance with the rule in effect at the time it was completed. So Hunt is the case that interprets this language. It was them arguing the position that now they're arguing the opposite.
But Mr. McPherson says that it just says that if it was valid at the time it was done, it stays valid. It doesn't say if it was invalid at the time it was done, it can't become valid.
Right, but this was more restrictive versus less restrictive. The new rule was more restrictive. Mm-hmm. In this case, the new rule is less restrictive. But they said that the language they chose in subparagraph 8 in Hunt, which was the exact language in this case, meant to make it prospective, that that's what they used the language for. And that language is clear and unambiguous, okay? There's an example in the Atkins case of a rule that's partially retroactive and partially prospective, and they clearly say it in the manner that makes that clear because there's a change in the rule. So it's my position that the Department of Revenue made two mistakes in this case. The first one, I believe, was not a mistake, that they changed R to AND, and I believe it was designed to make the testing more accurate. The second mistake was when they went to correct it, they didn't look at what subsection 8 said, because the language of subsection 8 and the cases that interpreted and the arguments that the Department of Revenue has made about that language in the past have all been consistent that it's the way we interpret it. And in fact, they changed their argument about Hunt between the Court of Appeals and this court. And normally when they've done that, courts have looked with disfavor on their arguments.
So it was and Hunt decided before the most recent amendment?
Yeah, Hunt was decided.
And so you're saying in
but it had the same language.
You're saying that in adopting the new language, changing from and to or, but leaving that language about prospective, retrospective the same, they were basically adopting the meaning of Hunt, because we say you normally can assume they're aware of current interpretations in the cases.
Right. And in the DeClue case, the Department of Revenue took the position that these were substantive, not procedural positions, and then they changed their position afterwards. So here's the bottom line. The bottom line is they passed a rule, they've dismissed these cases, they haven't introduced any evidence, okay, that it had some other purpose other than to make the machines more accurate, like all the other changes in the law. I mean, they were made for calibration and accuracy verifications. The final part I would make is, prior to this court's decision in White, the Department of Revenue held some special status. Since that case, they're to be treated the same as any party. It was their burden, it was their case. They did not follow the rules, they changed the rules, and they're trying to argue after the fact that these should apply retrospectively, and there's a small contingent of cases. Something like 82 cases with 14 or 15 judges that agreed this way. There were administrative hearing officers that agreed with the interpretation. We argue about what and are meant, and now they want to change it. And it's what Judge Teitelman said. It's like changing the law to fit the crime. Okay, they're trying to change the rules of the game, which are evidentiary rules, they are foundational rules, to suit their purpose. And the Eastern District got it right, and the Southern District got it wrong, and they referred to Farm 7, which, again, that was an after-the-fact justification of this. And I showed that in Farm 7, you can still use that farm and perform tests on different standards at the same time. And the federal government, as Judge Russell pointed out, actually requires that, and that's why we do that in Missouri as it relates to CDL licenses. Look at this. I finished. Oh, no, I went over. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Let's look at the plain language of subsection 8. Maintenance reports completed prior to the effective date of this rule shall be considered valid under this rule if the maintenance report was completed in compliance with the rules in effect at the time the maintenance was conducted. Now, the argument that's being made here is that the maintenance check at the time it was conducted was not in compliance with the rules. So subsection 8, by its own plain language, does not even apply to this type of situation. I think Hunt was right in applying subsection 8 to the facts of that case.
When you're talking about maintenance reporting, you're talking about one report or three reports again. In other words, that language could be read. You could say, yeah, that report was accurate. It just takes three in order for the evidence to be admitted.
I think if what's required is three reports to make it valid, then you have to have three reports. And I think that's okay. You know, the issue there is
and
that
how many were there in this case?
There was the one. done at the 10% solution level, as I recall.
Is there any evidence in the record as to, counsel argues that the and was added because that was more accurate to have the three solution levels. Is there any evidence of the record as to what a purpose would have been to add a different solution level as an alternative rather than as a triple check?
There's no specific evidence that goes to why that third solution level was made. But I would say this, though, is if the intent really was the idea that adding this third solution level is necessary to make these tests more accurate, why then would the department in less than 2 years go back and change that rule so that you don't have to have all
well,
three solution
levels?
Well,
presumably because officers were only doing one and they didn't want things thrown out. But so they changed it. But, I mean, opposing counsels identified a dozen states that use and they all, every state that we've been, that's been identified to us as having and in there requires each level of report to be made. You're saying and doesn't require each level of report to be made. Do you have any other states that use the word and that do not require multiple levels to be submitted?
I haven't gone through and checked through all the regulations.
But do you have any single other state that uses and that says it's okay just to give one report?
Well, again, what other states decide to write their rules is their business.
So I would guess that's not. I mean, but it's not, and often other states don't matter, but you're saying and doesn't really mean all three.
No, Your Honor, I am not saying that. I'm sorry. I'm not saying that and
doesn't
mean and.
You're saying in context. It doesn't mean that because of the forms and so forth.
Right.
So I'm asking, since all the other states that use and require multiple tests, you're saying, but Missouri's different. Missouri didn't mean it because the word form uses the word singular in the singular, but other states that use and all, I think there it's very relevant that you can't point to any other state that uses and that interprets it in the singular fashion.
Again, I think with those states, like with this state, you would have to look at the whole constellation of rules that govern this and look at what the scope of each rule is. If you've got a regulation that uses the word and clearly states that this is the procedure to be used in conducting the test, then that argument
Why would they require multiple levels of tests in those other states?
That's maybe the defense bar has convinced them that's the way to go. I don't know. Again, as a matter of policy, maybe it's a good idea, maybe it's not. But that's a matter for the Department of Health and Senior Services or for the legislature to determine. We're just saying that the rules as they are written did not require that at the time. And even if they did, that the retrospective application of the current rule, which no one is arguing does require three levels, is the appropriate to be used. And if I could make just one quick point, because I know I've gone over my time. As the attorney that filed the dismissal in all those cases that were referenced, they were dismissed because there were some problems with the state of the record, not because it was a concession. And the court may have gotten...
Is that part of the record, why they were dismissed?
No.
Okay.
It's absolutely
is that
properly
for us to consider?
It probably is not, and frankly, there you may have a letter that I addressed to the Court of Appeals in what was transferred, where I list two cases where the trials were held in December of 2013 that have not been dismissed and are still pending.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.